From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Throughout election season, Donald Trump referred to the media as dishonest and crooked, but that assessment is not limited to the president-elect. According to a recent Gallup poll, Americans' trust and confidence in the mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly has dropped to its lowest level in Gallup polling history. 32% of those polled say they have a great deal or fair amount of trust in the media. That's down 8 percentage points from last year, and it's fallen along partisan lines. According to that same poll, only 14% of Republicans say they trust the media. That's a drop of more than 50% compared to last year. Today, we're going to explore how the news media has changed over the years and specifically how it's adjusted to this unorthodox election cycle. With us is David Palitz, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at Duke University. David Palitz, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much. And pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question or an observation about how the news media reports on politics, particularly during an election cycle, give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. David Palitz, The New York Times wrote, "All the dazzling technology, the big data, and the sophisticated modeling that American newsrooms bring to the fundamentally human endeavor," he's laughing already, "of presidential politics could not save American journalism from yet again being behind the story, behind the rest of the country." In fact, the New York Times goes on to say the news media, by and large, missed what was happening all around it. And it was the story of a lifetime. The numbers weren't just a poor guide for election night. They were an off-ramp away from what was actually happening. How do you see this, David Palitz? What happened?
It's fascinating that the New York Times would render that opinion, since the New York Times is partly responsible, or is, one can see the failure embedded in the New York Times. But media is very tricky. It consists of news, it consists of opinion and commentary, it consists of analysis, and all of these often blur together, and people tend to confuse all that. What we have, if you just look at the public, is media illiteracy or a lack of media literacy into understanding how the media work, and particularly the news media.
When you say illiteracy, are you talking about members of the public understanding the difference between, say, commentary and a news piece?
Exactly. And understanding how the news media work. For example, if you just focus on news, when I teach, I talk about the criteria of news. That is, how do you explain what's covered and what isn't covered? Violence, conflict, those kinds of things. Once you understand how the news media operate and what they look for, then you can deal more effectively with questions of bias and objectivity and so on.
How does that vary from news organization to news organization? I mean, are the story selection criteria, the content, is that different for the BBC versus the New York Times or CNN?
Well, it's different, yes. It's different if the cable outlet, for example, MSNBC or more obviously Fox, is essentially partisan. In contrast to the New York Times, which is to some extent partisan, it's a liberal newspaper. Or in contrast to what CNN tries to do. And I can talk about the inadequacies of the CNN coverage and other outlets.
Well, let's talk about the bias. It sounds like, would you characterize the New York Times, for example, as a liberally biased news organization? Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I have...
And one way to do that would be to go back to the start of the election campaign and cull from the New York Times its headlines every day. And I would say, having examined them in some detail, that about 95% of them were negative toward Trump.
You're talking about the headlines,
headlines.
What the New York Times chose to cover, what the big stories were.
And how they characterized them, exactly.
So much of the media bias allegations during this election cycle originated from conservatives talking about the mainstream liberal media bias. Aside from the New York Times, is there a liberal bias in the mainstream media? Is that accurate?
Partly accurate, but much more important are the criteria of news that the media use. It's interesting, incidentally, if you watch Fox, which is a major media operation, they will talk about, the commentators on Fox will talk about the media as if they are not part of the media, as if they don't have their own particular biases and influence on a vast number of people.
Can you be partisan? Can you be more critical of, let's use the example of the two presidential candidates from the major parties, Clinton and Trump in this case. Can you be more critical, as the New York Times was of Trump and Fox News was of Clinton, than the other candidate and still be fair?
Sorry, I'm laughing.
Yeah, that's...
Because Fox's slogan, as you know, is fair and balanced.
Right.
And it is, of course, neither. But the problem, look, the problem with news is that no matter how factual, indeed even objective, some stories benefit one candidate rather than another. And so that's... People don't seem to understand it. They think of that as bias. But a story about someone engaging in sexual activity, untoward sexual activity, that's not a favorable story, no matter how accurate and truthful it is. Well, it may be a favorable story for some people, but most people will find that a negative portrayal. But to look at the media, in my view, the media essentially failed in this election. And it's not just failure to capture the fact that in a that there was extraordinary amount of discontent in a time of difficulty, but they failed because of a whole series of things. Let me see if I can mention some of them. They failed on policy. That is, there was hardly any discussion of the policy proposals of the candidates to the extent that there were some. And there was no discussion as far as, or very little discussion of the policies that would be relevant to the presidency, but neither candidate discussed.
Well, as you say that, David Palitz, I do remember seeing one early interview, George Stephanopoulos, who some could argue might not be the most appropriate for the position that he's currently in. But George Stephanopoulos was actually trying to drill down into policy questions and specifics with Donald Trump, specifically the wall. And it was a verbal arm wrestling match in terms of pinning him down. I mean, was there a point at which the mainstream media sort of gave up because of the way the doublespeak and if you've read a transcript of some of Trump's comments when it came to policy positions, no matter what the question was, there was always this very sort of general answer, you know, it's going to be great. Mexico's going to pay for the wall. How does a reporter deal with, how do you get past that?
Well, he made lots of other assertions and claims. Corruption, D.C. is a swamp, of corruption. The Obama administration, ironically, is probably one of the least corrupt administrations in American history, in the sense of financial chicanery and the like. So he could have been pushed on that. He could have been pushed far more on what he meant by rigged. He could have been pushed on, and she could have been pushed too. What do you mean when you say, I'm going to bring back jobs? What do you mean by a military buildup? What are your policies toward Iran? What are your policies toward China? Did China really invent climate, the problems with climate, to benefit the Democrats? A whole slew of what I would refer to is as analysis. Analysis of the candidates' claims, arguments, was missing. Not to mention, of course, all the policies that were not discussed by either candidate. What to do about Afghanistan, what to do about North Korea, what to do, how education subsidies would work, and so on. So that's one, I think, major failure of the media. The failure to deal with policies.
And you're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Dr. David Palitz of Duke University, it's been a pleasure having you with us today, and we'll have to have you back. When we return after the break, we'll continue this conversation about media bias and public mistrust of news organizations. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are now open. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today about why trust in the media has plummeted during this election cycle. And joining us now from Duke University is Ellen Mickiewicz. She is the James R. Shipley Emeritus Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University and the author of No Illusions, The Voices of Russia's Future Leaders. Ellen Mickiewicz, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Also joining us now is Jennifer Brubaker, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, in the Communication Studies Department. She is also the coordinator of the Journalism Minor and co-coordinator of the Campaign Management Minor. Jennifer Brubaker, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to ask a question about elections coverage and the evolution of news in this country, or comment on how you've seen media bias play out, give us a call during this live Thursday show at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Dr. David Palitz from Duke University was explaining this failure of journalism in the recent presidential election, why the media just missed it. And one of the points that he raised was the lack of coverage of in-depth policy positions. And, you know, before the election, we heard critics of journalists say, oh, if only news would cover those actual policy positions, and it may not be sexy and it may be boring, it may be hard to sell, but that would be solid coverage. Ellen Mickiewicz, is that true? I mean, so many of what would be negatives in the case of Donald Trump, for instance, were out there. People knew about them. But that didn't matter. That wasn't the point.
No, it wasn't the point. And the reason it wasn't the point, and the media essentially missed what was the point, and that is a kind of mass revolt, mass dissatisfaction of a very large swath of the electorate that traditionally voted in a different way for a different party. That whole driving mechanism behind these results was fundamentally missed.
And why? Why did everybody miss it? I mean, you had some fringe pundits say Donald Trump is going to win in a landslide, but those were fringe and they weren't taken seriously. Why?
And they had no context. And that, I think, is one of the answers to your question, and that is that much of the reporting, if not most, had no contextual base. And therefore, they said they would go to the usual sources or go to a state and see whom they will run into. Now, that's not context. That's a kind of random turkey shoot. What you really need is a profound understanding of what has been happening and broadly and deeply. And I think, frankly, that most of the people who covered it didn't have that.
So if you then, you're news director in a large newsroom, and you're sending reporters out then to cover this campaign, this is pre-election, how would you do that so it's not a turkey shoot, so it is a broader, deeper capture of what's really happening in this country?
Well, my first rule for sending people out would be to know a great deal about polls and what they don't mean and what they do mean. We're learning that only afterward. Secondly, I'd send them out long before the election, assuming I had the financial resources to do that, and that's a problem. I'd send them out earlier. So that they would immerse themselves in all the aspects of the particular area that they were assigned to. And I'd have several in different areas, but all of them with their understanding of history and context, which presumably they come in with, but if they don't, they have to get it, would be immersed and would have a much stronger base or basis on which to understand what's happening.
Jennifer Brubaker, one of the issues that came up earlier is media bias and the perception of media bias being partly due to media illiteracy, members of the public not understanding the difference between commentary, punditry, and actual journalism. How do you teach your students at UNCW the difference?
To have them understand that commentary and reporting are not the same thing, and to be able to distinguish between the difference. That people who are reporters, they follow a standard of ethics. They follow a standard process for gathering information, for fact-checking information, for providing the news, providing information function of the media. But analysis and the analysts who are brought in, they're oftentimes the experts who are there to lend their opinion to the matter. And that can provide some of that context, but as long as it's a fairness type situation where both sides are being shown, but it can provide some of that context beyond the traditional reporting of it. Now, the problem is when people only either get one side of that or an imbalance in the sides of that and don't understand that this is coming from a biased source, that this is the professional opinion on it, but that's exactly what it is. It's an opinion on it. And so many times people don't understand the difference between that.
And, you know, that's something that we saw particularly with CNN and Ellen Mitzkevich, if you want to weigh in on this, when the scandal with Donna Brazile erupted. She obviously is an important person within the Democratic Party. She was also a paid pundit for CNN, and she leaked questions before a presidential debate to the Clinton campaign. She was ultimately fired from CNN for that. But is that emblematic of a larger problem here?
Well, there is, you know, this is just, this is just naturally how the relationship works between the media and the candidates, and now you bring in this partisan pundit type thing, that there is this give and take relationship and this closeness, and they depend on each other for certain things. However, that's where you kind of run into the problem, because journalists realize the lines sometimes between this relationship and realize that while they can have a good relationship and they can feed off of the candidates or the leaders and they can feed off of each other and they have a very good professional working relationship, you throw in someone who is this third party, this pundit, who is now coming in as a paid professional who naturally leans towards one side, has a strong relationship with that side, who does not adhere to those standards of ethics because they're not a journalist. That's where you're going to run into this gray area, and that's what we saw with Donna Brazile.
Ellen Mickiewicz.
Rachel, perhaps I could add something.
Yes.
And also answer your question. Just before, when we were talking about commentary versus opinion, you know, it seems to me a fact is not a fact without context. If I told you that there were 75 million bison in Montana, that is meaningless, unless I also tell you that from the verge of extinction because of both governmental and commercial interests, et cetera, a fact all by itself cannot be interpreted. So it's what's around it that's very, very important and has to be deep. Now, coming to this question of Donna Brazile and pundits, this is, to my mind, a very, very not only dangerous, but unfruitful path that the media have gone into. And that is that, I say, Corey Lewandowski fired and becomes a CNN analyst. That's how he's identified.
You're talking about Trump's former campaign manager who was then hired by CNN.
Yes, thank you. And then former Reagan operative, former such and such operative. Well, these people are either hosting sometimes or commenting from a, quote, expert position sometimes. But the problem is that the audience hears another stump speech. Every one of them just continues the kind of partisan stump speech of their favorite candidate. Now, that's not analysis. That's not news. And it's certainly not journalism. So that it becomes, it's actually, you cringe before the television set when they move to that table of so-called pundits, because they're not pundits. They're giving you the same partisan line that they had when they were in a campaign and before they were called CNN or ABC analysts. That's a very bad trend, in my view.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring the evaporation of trust in news organizations, whether it's warranted, how it's come about, and how the media changed to adjust to this unorthodox presidential election season. Today, we're talking with Ellen Mickiewicz. She is the James R. Shipley Emeritus Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University and the author of No Illusions, The Voices of Russia's Future Leaders. We also have Jennifer Brubaker with us, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, in the Communication Studies Department. And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Bo from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I've got just 2 points. First, as a conservative, I get frustrated with the media because in the past it's always been that they've been biased, in my opinion, but this year they became oppositional to Donald Trump and two other conservative candidates. They had an agenda to defeat him instead of giving commentary. And secondly, you know, HQR and NPR are somewhat guilty of this. You've got Morning Edition, you've got All Things Considered, you got Diane Rehm, you got Debbie Gross, but you don't have a conservative alternative. And I don't think you need to, you know, I don't think Click and Clack is a conservative alternative, but you need to have a little balance.
You know, Bo, you raise an interesting point, because Morning Edition and All Things Considered are, of course, news magazines. And I think every journalist involved in the NPR organization and member stations would say there is a great deal of effort made to make sure that that is absolutely not biased coverage.
Yeah, well, and I've heard that from you before, but it's...
But Diane Rehm is a different... Hold on, let me finish, Bo. Diane Rehm is a different animal, and I think that most reasonable people who are listening objectively would say, yes, we hear bias in the Diane Rehm talk show. And Terry Gross, of course, is not a news person. She does an interview show that is often focused on issues, but that's entertainment. It's not news. Do you see a difference there between
well,
what
I
you...
Well, I do see a difference. I do see a difference, but I don't see an alternative for a conservative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's that. No, certainly not.
Okay.
That,
well, then, but aren't you don't my tax dollars support NPR? And shouldn't I have a fair, a reasonable assumption that I would get a little more conservative view at times?
Well, a tiny amount of tax dollars go towards the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
You're not a pro-profit.
But that's a different question from should we be fair? Absolutely, yes. And Jennifer Brubaker, can you weigh in on this? The perception of liberal bias when it comes to not talking about talk shows, but NPR's news coverage.
The news coverage, and traditionally when we follow and we study news coverage versus analysis, the news coverage itself, not just speaking of NPR, but speaking of media outlets in general, the actual reporting is typically very standard, objective, unbiased. What I think Bo is referring to is all of the additional content. And that's where we're seeing that, that's where we are seeing that bias, as you acknowledge. That's where we're seeing a little bit more of the partisanship. We're seeing the bias out there. And he does pose a very valid question that a lot of voters and a lot of media consumers are concerned about, that there is definitely bias in that. As long as we can recognize the difference, that's the first step. And that's the idea of becoming media literate and being able to say, I can see that the reporting, that's objective. But now I can recognize the difference that we're moving into commentary, we're moving into analysis, we're moving into interview programming and such. Now, what he's posing, and I do to somewhat agree with him in many capacities, is that you see a lot of the commentary programs, you see a lot of the analysis program, the pundits that are on, and they do tend to fall one way over the other. And you definitely, you see Fox News come along and hold the conservative perspective, but then you're seeing a lot weighted onto the more liberal perspective. So I don't think that the problem is in reporting. The reporting is consistently across the board. We are not biased. What you are definitely seeing is the other sources, the other parts, they do tend to be weighted more, and that's just in the quantity and not anything beyond that. There just are more liberal sources, and I think that's what he's posing as being, we should include more.
Ellen Mitzkevich.
yes. Thank you. Could I just, excuse me, can I just add, I think there's also a deeper layer it's in this last election, and that is, just as we saw the division in the Republican Party about the candidate, so the conservative journalists, for example, the New York Times conservative voice, David Brooks, increasingly, as the campaign went on, became himself concerned and looking for something else and seeing problems for the country as a whole in that candidate. And that came through in his columns. He went, in a sense, from conservative to something that was not so conservative, if you say that Trump represents the conservative part. And that was because he himself became, I believe, disillusioned. I had come up to Duke to teach a course because I wanted to have a conservative voice on the history of conservatism from a well-educated and rather profound person. Mm-hmm. And he can do that. Mm-hmm. But this election cycle created a real problem for conservative commentary.
Bo, thanks so much for that call. You raise an interesting point that I think we're all going to be chewing on for a while. Jennifer Brubaker.
I think the conservative bias that he's referring to and that is coming up is one of the things that maybe, or the liberal bias rather, that's coming up is one of the things that contributed to what has happened in the last couple of days and the surprise that has happened. When you have so many more voices of those commentators and of the analysts, when you have so many more voices that are creating a narrative, and that's, I think, one of the problems with the media coverage of this election cycle is that the media fell victim to its own narrative. They created this story that this is what they saw and this is what they wanted to see and this is where they were headed with it, whether it's coming from reporters, but it's coming from.
But why is the media so disconnected from the people that the media is reporting on? How does that gap emerge?
I think part of it is the urban versus rural difference. I think that that's a huge thing. You know, you hear a lot about now about the coasts and the media centers on the coasts and that they are just not in touch. And when we're talking about what do we need to do to train journalists to be in touch with the public and immersed in the culture.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about why trust in the media has taken a dive and what news organizations might do to remedy that. Is the news changing permanently? How do we adjust to changing media and technology? With us today to answer your questions, Duke University Professor Ellen Mickiewicz and UNCW Associate Professor Jennifer Brubaker. We have a full phone bank. When we come back, we'll try to get to all of these phone calls. You can email us during this live Thursday show at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking about trust in the media, why it's taken a hit, particularly over the last 12 months, and whether the coverage of the presidential election was a failure of journalism. With us today to answer your questions, Ellen Mickiewicz. She is the James R. Shipley Emeritus Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at Duke University and the author of No Illusions, The Voices of Russia's Future Leaders. We also have Jennifer Brubaker, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, in the Communication Studies Department. And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. Actually, we have one line open at this point, but the phone number is 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I promised we would get to some of these calls. Sean from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hello, Sean.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. You know, there's all these things are kind of interrelated. The point made earlier about the so-called pundits that are actually political flacks. And, you know, if you watch CNN for this news cycle, it was like dinner at your crazy uncle's house where you've got four people shouting over each other. And it's not information. It's not, it's certainly not unbiased. And it doesn't give you anything that you can walk away with. And I think that's part of what has happened to the media really since the 24-hour news cycle, where it's become as much about entertainment and trying to hold your interest as it is about actually giving you viable information.
Ellen Mickiewicz, thank you so much. That's a very good point, Sean. Ellen Mickiewicz, can you talk about filling time on cable news with this 24-hour news cycle and what that's done to reporting?
Oh, I think that's a real problem. First of all, I want to say to the caller how much I appreciate his remarks because I couldn't agree more. And filling the news cycle, filling 24 hours is really very difficult. And the ratings are very low for many of those 24 hours, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. The ratings are very low on, if you look at Nielsen. So in a sense, you can sort of divide and partition off a good part of those 24 hours. On the other hand, you have not only journalists who have to contribute all the time and update all the time, something new all the time, but also very often, if you look at NBC, they also have to be giving material to MSNBC or to CNBC and NBC and updating all of it, and it's online. Now, what, and staffs are being reduced for economic reasons. So all of this is obviously going to lead to a more superficial, less well-educated understanding of what it is that they're reporting. So we either have to change our model of teaching, I think, or preparing journalists. We have to perhaps think twice, that is the news organizations, about whom they hire, and if there are constrained resources, to think very hard about whether to spread them out and have superficial coverage, or whether to focus and to achieve a reputation and a credibility, because the credibility of the news source is the most powerful part of understanding and persuasion.
Well, you talk about the constant updates needed from journalists, sort of degrading the quality of their reporting and the depth of it. Ben Steelman, one of our favorite reporters at the Star News, asks, can you talk about the role of social media? What does that do to the quality of journalism? Jennifer Brubaker.
Well, we often refer to media as being a window to the world and a reflection of our world. And so much of us with social media are seeing, we can all look through our personal Facebook feeds and see this discussion and this anger and this, you know, this arguing and the perspectives that are out there. And we think that that's often, you know, that's a reflection of those same type of programming that we're referring to that we're seeing on this 24-hour news coverage. So what you're seeing in your Facebook feeds and that people are regurgitating, they're using those talking points, not that they're getting from the news, they're using the talking points that they're getting from those screaming matches on of the pundits, and they're bringing them into their own personal interactions. Similarly, they're providing that same, they're reflecting our own discussions and the online interactions that people are having, they're reflecting those in the TV version for our entertainment purposes.
Ellen Mitzkevich, David Howell asks this question. He says, this election, one fault that has to be attributed to most media outlets was to not take Trump's chances as seriously as they should have. So if media, if journalists had taken him seriously a year ago and said this guy really could be the next president of the United States, would that have changed reporting?
It might have. The media, broadly understood, in 2015, gave Mr. Trump, President-elect Trump, an enormous amount of free time. That is, he was on shows, he was covered, but free time that was used primarily because this was an entertaining figure. This was a dramatic figure. And many news outlets thought this is good. It's good commercially. It attracts viewers, and it keeps them watching or listening. But even though he had all that extra time, it was not serious extra time. By extra, I mean much more than any other candidate. And so they did not, in fact, treat him as a serious candidate, even though he was all over the place and reveling in that. And that's one of the reasons why he became a serious candidate, was because he became very well known for the leap from The Apprentice to his ambitions for the presidency.
So, Ellen Mitzkevich, are you saying that Donald Trump in the White House is partly a creation of the media?
Well, I think it's inescapable to think very seriously about that. I do think that all of that coverage he got did help him to cross that bridge from being irrelevant to national politics with no experience to somebody who becomes a real a national figure and whose identity becomes more and more fixed and understandable to people.
Jennifer,
but
go ahead, finish your thought.
I just to finish quickly, but it was done in a way that did not challenge him, that treated him as an exotic being, so that he got the best of both worlds. He got the attention, he got the time, and he did not get serious probing.
I would have to agree with that, and I think that more than Donald Trump being a creation of the media, I actually would think that the media coverage and this media narrative were a creation of the Trump campaign. And one of the very first things that I try to teach in my political communication courses is that the candidates who are the most successful are the ones who are the most media savvy. We saw that in 2008 with President Obama. He was the most media savvy candidate. And at that point, it was really grasping social media. Well, President-elect Trump was incredibly media savvy in learning how to create the narrative that he wanted to and play into to get that free media coverage, to get it focused on, and essentially to point the media the way that he wanted them to, which you wouldn't think would be the scandal and the controversy. But when you're playing to voters who are already looking with media cynicism, that really played into his strategy.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the evaporation of trust in the media, how much of it's warranted. And we have Steve from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. And thanks to WHQR for hosting this timely show. As timely as it may be, there are certain media critics, Jay Rosen, I believe of CUNY, for example, who have been raising many of these issues for 6 months or more. So, Rachel, my question is actually for you. How have these discussions, past, media, present, informed, because you are a media outlet and you are a reporter, how have these questions and issues informed what it is that you do in WHQR?
Well, I can tell you, Steve, that we question ourselves every single day on what we're doing and how we're approaching it, whether it comes to the production of a news piece for one of the morning or afternoon news magazines, or whether it's putting together a discussion like this for Coastline. And this is an excellent question about continuing to question oneself as a journalist, one's perhaps unconscious biases and motivations for doing certain stories and not doing others. Jennifer Brubaker, how do you teach your students how to recognize some of those inner biases that they may not even know they have?
I think it's a matter of making them, first of all, recognize where they their own political socialization. I mean, really, we talk about a lot about political socialization and the process of how they got to be where they are today and who they are today and how that's evolving and as they move forward and recognizing those things. But in a similar vein, recognizing that they are social scientists. And although they can have those, they can have those feelings, they can have those opinions, that no more than a scientist can walk into an experiment with his or her own preconceived notions about what should or could happen, they still have to set them aside to conduct the actual experiment. It's the same thing when you're a social scientist. You have to set those preconceptions aside, but until you recognize how you got to be where you are and that personal inventory, you struggle with that. So if you can recognize those factors and set them aside and say, I'm coming at it from this perspective and I need to be overtly conscious of that, they can provide better coverage.
Thank you so much for that call, Steve. You raise a great point. Ellen Mickiewicz, how do you approach that? Is there a point, do you think, in a journalist's career when they've been at it so long or they've been so successful that they stop questioning themselves?
Oh, I think so. And I think it has a lot to do with columnists, usually, who achieve great fame and are lionized, asked to speak on campuses, and they essentially make a series of assertions, and so I'm not sure that's such a good idea that journalists become in themselves celebrities and are treated as celebrities. I think working journalists, that title would be, for me, a much more a preferable title, so that they are always questioning. I have been looking at much of say New York Times coverage for a while, and increasingly it seems to me it become the news that's reported is really a part of the kind of herd mentality in which what the government and what other media are saying, what Congress might be saying, what NATO might be saying, and caught up in that and not being able to get out of that because it's the dominant conversation, the dominant narrative that's so broadly understood. And I think that we have, unfortunately, almost only a sprinkling of those who will get out of this accepted narrative. And is there room for that? Where would they be published? Where would they have a chance to get on? So I see that happening more and more, and I think it may be in part due to the kind of fear and anxiety that much of the country is experiencing after random, unpredictable, and mortal attacks from terrorists. So I think there's a kind of narrowing, and perhaps because of unease and personal insecurity, but there's a narrowing of the range of discussion.
Just a minute or so left, and I want to hear from both of you. Jennifer Brubaker, quickly, how does the news media need to work to restore public confidence?
They need to make overt efforts at cleansing out problems that we've already recognized or we're recognizing exist to make certain that they're including the majority of the population, including not just the majority of the numbers of the people, but the majority of areas and the problems and the social issues that they face every day.
Ellen Mickiewicz, what do we need to do to restore our credibility?
I think the source credibility is the question, and it's the right question. I think we need to prepare the journalist deeply and understand the whole context and more history.
That's this edition of Coastline. Jennifer Brubaker of UNCW and Ellen Mickiewicz of Duke University and author of No Illusions, The Voices of Russia's Future Leaders. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Duke University Professor David Palitz. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Tune in for Coastline each Wednesday and Thursday at noon. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. You can also tune in for the rebroadcast on Sunday in the afternoon at 2 p.m. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.